Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
We also have here with us today Shannon Tiezzi. Thanks a lot for joining us, Shannon.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
As I'm sure readers and listeners know, Shannon's our China editor, so we're very happy to have us here today as we discuss Xi Jinping, China's president's trip to South Asia. And now we're going to begin this with actually discussing his trip to India, which is actually the final leg of his trip and is actually still taking place as we record this podcast. And this visit has probably represented one of the most interesting interactions between India and China at a high level in some time, mostly due to the fact that Narendra Modi, the Indian Prime Minister, and Xi Jinping seem to be having a great time in India, both in Gujarat, Modi's home state, and in New Delhi, while Indian troops and PLA troops are having a major standoff in Kashmir on the border of the Ladakh region along the line of actual control. So this represents a very interesting scenario because on one hand, you have this perpetual tactical problem in India-China relations, which is these border incursions that occur and are essentially resolved on the tactical level between the troops themselves. That was a big part of last October's border defense cooperation agreement between India and China that the former Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh signed during his last trip to China. Now, I guess the first question I have for you guys is, do you think that this visit is an example of China maybe misstepping on its diplomacy or making a mistake? Or is this something that's been carefully planned out to test Narendra Modi's strategic reflexes?
Oh, I think it can actually be both. It can be something that they planned out. I certainly don't think this is just a case of Chinese PLA troops marching over the border, kind of going rogue, as some people like to think about China's military. But I also think that it is a mistake. This trip was supposed to be all about China-India cooperation, all about economic compatibilities, kind of a new golden age for Asian development spearheaded by these two giant developing nations of China and India. And now all that anyone outside of the Chinese media wants to talk about is the border issue. What's going on with the border issue? Can China and India ever actually trust each other? And all of the goodwill economic initiatives that Xi brought with him to India are kind of getting overlooked to some extent.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think I'm with Shannon. I think we have to raise the possibility that it's definitely possible that these are like rogue PLA soldiers. But I never really buy that argument. I don't see the PLA really ever you know, disagreeing or disobeying the Communist Party. And I don't think unless we have some evidence that we can really continue to claim all this as rogue PLA soldiers. So I think that Shannon's right that you know, it's probably calculated, but that doesn't mean that that's not a mistake on China's part. A lot of, I think, the wrong-headed or foolish Chinese diplomacy, Chinese strategic moves recently have been carefully planned. The U.S. carefully planned the Iraq war. It still turned into a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with both of what you guys said. I think it's interesting to also look at the reaction because both Modi and Xi acknowledge that this dispute exists and specifically that this standoff is currently occurring. Specifically, Modi called for India and China to clarify the line of actual control. Now, this has sort of been a point of contention. India and China have signed a couple agreements, if my dates are right, I think once in the early 90s and again in the 2000s regarding the status of the line of actual control. But obviously, there's still plenty of ambiguities for both PLA and Indian commanders on the ground. So I think both leaders expressed some interest in leading up to maybe a larger strategic summit on the issue of border disputes. The other issue, which is the separate dispute of Arunachal Pradesh in India's northeast, which China calls South Tibet and claims in almost its entirety, was left off the negotiating table a bit. And I think that's a significantly more complicated dispute. Anyways, just turning over to the economic side of this visit, which, you know, admittedly does exist, even though the strategic issues and the border disputes are far more interesting on some level. A lot of people were surprised that China only ended up pledging $20 billion in aid over 5 years to India when speculation before the visit, particularly by comments made by a Chinese diplomat in Mumbai, indicated that China would contribute something to the tune of $100 billion. Now, Shannon, did you ever expect that that would be a realistic number for any sort of Chinese deal with India, or was the $20 billion about what you expected when it came to what China had to offer India at this time?
I think that 20 billion is a far more reasonable number. When you're seeing reports of 100 billion and some sites are saying up to 300 billion, that's just so far out of range with China's previous amounts of donations to India that it's extreme. And I think what was playing into that was people were putting too much emphasis on this idea of Xi Jinping needing to one-up Shinzo Abe. The Japanese government, of course, promised $37 billion over 5 years in investment to India. So I think a lot of people thought Xi Jinping was really going to try to send a strong message. You know, oh, they say $37 billion, we say $100 billion. And the fact that he actually lowballed Shinzo Abe and came in with only $20 billion in deals is a bit surprising, but we shouldn't overlook the fact that this is still a massive, massive increase in Chinese investment in India.
I think that, first of all, Japan's a larger Japan's outward foreign direct investment is still larger than China's as of last year. So, I mean, that doesn't make – I don't think that's too perplexing that Japan's would be higher. But I also would just say that it's not necessarily just China. I mean, this is a two-way street. And India might have a lot of concerns about money pouring into – especially for infrastructure, pouring in from China, given the strategic rivalry they have. And also, they have a massive trade imbalance. And one of India's main points has been, like, you know, trying to reduce this trade imbalance. So more Chinese money going into India is not – I know it's not necessarily the trade imbalance, but it's still the same kind of sort of problem, China sending exports of goods and stuff, but not necessarily buying stuff from India.
Yeah, and I think that's something that they actually addressed. Under the investment plans, there's actually three main areas that China is working with India now. The first is to improve Indian infrastructure, like you said, Zach, particularly focusing on railway systems based off of this latest visit. And also Chinese investment will be used to set up industrial parks in the Indian states of Gujarat and Maharashtra. And the final peg of the economic agreements is actually to open the Chinese market up more to Indian pharmaceuticals and agricultural products, hopefully to bring that $40 billion trade balance in a bit, which is a major concern for Indian leaders, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is also another one of these border – like, this is just like the border issue where every time India and Chinese leaders meet, they pledge to do something to fix the trade imbalance, but nothing really seems to ever get done on it.
Yeah, we'll have to see if they actually manage to follow up on these agreements.
Now, well, of course, it's been a huge issue in China-U.S. relations for decades now, and still every year it gets a little bit bigger. You know, there's only so much that you can do unless you're going to firmly control the market to end the imbalance.
Yeah. I mean, I do think one of the things that might change about this now, one of the reasons why we should maybe be optimistic about it changing is that if China's economic rebound actually takes place, you know, its consumption is going to be growing, so just using market forces, you know, will probably help the imbalance a little bit. And the other thing is that with wages rising in China, this is more long-term, medium-term to long-term, with wages rising in China, one of the a lot of the companies that have factories in China are moving elsewhere over time, and one places that they're moving is potentially moving is India, so India might see its manufacturing boon even as China's decreases, and then so that might also over the medium long term help fix the trade imbalance.
Yeah, just stepping back really briefly to the border dispute issue and these broader strategic issues between India and China, where do you guys see Narendra Modi in terms of the political capital he has domestically in being able to deal with China? Because obviously, you know, this is a different government in India. It's not a Congress party government. The Congress received a lot of criticism for essentially appeasing China on several issues and not bringing up the border dispute issues. Modi, to his credit, has been vocal about the issue of what he calls Chinese expansionism abroad. Even if he doesn't name China directly, it's very clear who he's talking about in most of these scenarios. He went as far to directly bring this issue up with Xi Jinping, which is honestly something I could not imagine Manmohan Singh doing, really. It also comes back to the fact that many members of his party are obviously far more hawkish than he is on the China issue. Particularly, India's home minister has been the one spearheading these new development projects in the northeast in Arunachal Pradesh that are sure to upset China, including specifically settling new Indian citizens in these areas, moving people, actually making the border areas more widely inhabited to deter Chinese incursions. But I don't know. So how do you think Narendra Modi is situated politically to handle border disputes with China over his, you know, next 4 years in office?
I actually think you should handle that question.
Yeah.
You're right.
Well, yeah. I mean, my two cents, like I said, I mean, he seems to be, I mean, so obviously he didn't go as far as to, you know, he could have, so the most extreme action that Modi could have taken in such a scenario is essentially postponed the rest of the visit, ended it early, made some sort of declaration that this is absolutely unacceptable and India can't talk to China on this level. He could have refused Chinese funding. He did none of these things. And obviously these are extreme measures that any Indian leader probably won't be in a good political state after conducting. I mean, obviously this, you know, moves like that would have maybe gotten him some headway with India's extreme right, who are quite hawkish on China. But I think Modi's measured reaction was probably just about in the right place to placate both his supporters and his critics. I mean, for his critics, he still continued to deliver on his promise of developing economic relations with countries that India has significant relations with. But at the same time, he, you know, did raise this issue with China. And hopefully, I mean, the signs I'm seeing, I can easily imagine during Modi's term, some sort of broader India-China strategic summit dealing with this issue. I don't know, but that's just my two cents. If you guys have anything to add to that, I'm always, you know, always ears.
I don't personally. I think that seems about right to me.
Yeah, I think just expanding on the point that you made in your comments, I think Modi is in an interesting position in that he really needs to have a good relationship with China to achieve his goal of a massive economic growth for India. China's major market in the Asia Pacific, India can't really do without that. But on the same level, he doesn't want to fall into the trap of overly appeasing China. And a lot of the moves that he's made have both allowed him to say that he's standing firm while letting the Chinese government save face. And the example of his comments on expansionism is a great example of that, because he purposefully didn't name any country. He said some countries' expansionist tendencies. And of course, you know, everyone in the US and Japan was interpreting that to mean China. But within China itself, because it was in the context of a larger commentary on how this isn't the 18th century anymore, the Chinese interpreted that to be a comment against the US and the imperialist powers. So it allowed Modi to criticize China without having to actually take the heat for criticizing China. And if he can keep doing that, I think India will be in a great position going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have this theory, well, maybe not a theory, maybe it's more of a hypothesis, that I think what Modi is trying to do with Indian foreign policy is recast it, if not entirely turn it 180 degrees, take it from non-alignment, which was India's historic foreign policy position, which focused heavily on strategic autonomy, to something that resembles more omni-alignment, which is essentially the idea that India can have good relations with the US, with Russia, with China, and essentially have deep economic ties with all these countries while not really making strategic progress, but, you know, addressing areas for strategic growth in all these relationships. I think that's something that maybe I'll have more evidence to support once we see how his visit to the United States goes.
Yeah. That'll be really interesting to see how this U.S. visit plays out, especially after this China visit.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people have been saying that, I think it was Euro Asia Group, they were, I think I read an analyst analysis from them earlier this week saying that they expect Japan to overtake the U.S. as China's like main partner moving forward. I mean, I don't have much expectations for the U.S.-India visit, but going back to the other point that Shannon was making about, I think that one of the interesting things with the India-China relationship is it really trying to kind of lets us see what Modi's real priorities are from foreign policy and diplomacy more generally, because he has to, like we've been talking about, he has to balance the economics versus you know, the strategic issues. So if he does kind of waver on like standing up to China, then I think that really goes to show just how big of a priority the economy is for him, whereas if he stands up on the strategic issues, that says something else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think ultimately, though, Modi's view of fixing India's economy does begin with domestic policy. He has been really dynamic in foreign policy, obviously in his first 100 days and beyond in office, but ultimately I think his view is that, you know, India's economy will have to begin at home. Let's take the remaining time on this podcast to just discuss the other legs of Xi Jinping's South Asia trip, because there are other countries in South Asia apart from India, despite India's massive, massive status there. So just to put this in context, Xi was at the SCO summit in Dushanbe, following which he was supposed to visit Pakistan, but that got canceled because of the political crisis of that country, and we can discuss the implications of that. And possibly, I wrote a piece on why maybe she should have taken the opportunity to stop by in Afghanistan if he wasn't going to Pakistan. And then after that, she ended up stopping by in the Maldives and in Sri Lanka, two small island states in the Indian Ocean, where a big part of his focus was the Maritime Silk Road. Now, Shannon, could you just tell us a bit more about, you know, what exactly the Maritime Silk Road entails? It seems to be a very nebulous initiative at this point, but I think there's some interesting strategic factors that are at play there for China.
Sure. So the Maritime Silk Road is kind of a counterpart to the 21st Century Silk Road, which is an overland route. And both of these are meant to economically link China with the West. So the overland Silk Road is going to go through Central Asia, the Middle East, potentially as far west as Europe. And the Maritime Silk Road will leave from southern China, travel through Southeast Asia, up through the Indian Ocean, with stops in the island states like the Maldives and Sri Lanka, obviously stops in India as well. They've been trying to get India to get on board with this project. So it's really, as you said, it's a nebulous concept other than increased economic cooperation along this route. It's not really clear what being a part of this entails. Is it just going to be a series of bilateral relationships that each of these countries will have with China, or is China envisioning some sort of larger economic zone, potentially even a free trade zone among these countries, so that they're linked with each other as well as with China? That's currently not clear right now, especially along the Maritime Silk Road. It seems to be bound together by Chinese offers of investments in infrastructure and ports, particularly in Sri Lanka, in the port at Colombo that they've been pouring billions of dollars into. It's not really clear exactly what it entails, and I think that might be why you're seeing a little bit of hesitation on the part of India. They basically said, we're interested, but they haven't embraced the concept the way that the leaders in the Maldives and Sri Lanka have.
Yeah, I think based on what I'm hearing, China is expected to clarify this concept a lot more at the APEC summit later this year. Is that correct?
Yes. But again, we're not sure exactly how much they're going to clarify it. A lot of times these grand diplomatic schemes that China comes out with, even when they're clarified, still remain fairly nebulous. So we'll have
enough
to see how much they actually clarify it in terms of concrete ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a broader concept of just increasing connectivity across Asia to facilitate trade between China and Africa and the Middle East, which, you know, obviously harkens back to the original idea of the Silk Road in antiquity. But I think the port issue is what's particularly interesting for countries like India, because, you know, there's been strategic paranoia in India about a so-called Chinese string of pearls growing both in Southeast Asia and possibly in the Indian Ocean. I think the Maritime Silk Road might be China's attempt to recast that in a more positive economic light.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting, oh, sorry, Zach, it could also take on security components again, but in a different way than maybe the string of pearls. At the same time that Xi was traveling to the Maldives and Sri Lanka, the China ASEAN Expo was going on in China, and the Chinese officials there were talking about involving ASEAN in the Maritime Silk Road, but it had a kind of strange security focus. They were talking about, you know, interactions between their maritime police forces, effectively the Coast Guards, and taking on more responsibility for ensuring security of trade, not just for increasing trade. And that long term could be China's bid to kind of oust the U.S. from its role as the guarantor of freedom of navigation of the trade route that cross through the South China Sea and the Malacca Strait, because that is exactly the route that this Maritime Silk Road would take.
Yeah, I definitely think that's I definitely see it as that long term, and I don't think the China will clarify really at APEC what this is. But I see all these initiatives together in a broader sense of the way I've been thinking about it recently is basically China's trying to make itself the Middle Kingdom. It's trying to connect all these different regions. It's trying to become the hub that connects all these different regions. Because the Maritime Silk Road also, you know, goes to Southeast Asia and stuff, and so it's building rail links to for all the way to Europe and like through Russia and the Middle East, and then it will be, you know, so that it can send ship goods through the rails either to China from Europe in the Middle East in Central Asia, and then through maritime to like Southeast Asia and Japan and Korea, or it can ship goods from Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia through China to these other countries. So I think it's really, the security component is important, but I think just economically, it's trying to make itself indispensable and make itself the Middle Kingdom, you know, where everything else circles. It starts and ends really in China.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is going to be one of the themes that we're going to see a lot more about in Chinese foreign policy, at least over the coming year, and hopefully see more of a shape and more concrete plans from Beijing.
Well, this is
as
really,
we go forward.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
This is really how you establish hegemony, or whatever you want to call it, in the modern era. I mean, no one, I think, thinks that China's going to, you know, take over and occupy all of Southeast Asia or all of, you know, Central Asia, but, like, just the way the U.S. But the U.S. doesn't, like, occupy Latin America or the Western Hemisphere, but it has hegemony by being, you know, having these, like, sort of indirect strangle points to all these different countries. And I think that China's really just, through these initiatives, is trying to establish the same sort of dominance over the region.
Yeah. We'll see going forward, I guess. And then just the final point that I want to address is the Pakistan leg of Xi's South Asia tour, which ended up getting canceled. Shannon, what's your read on this? So the way I see it is that this was essentially from Islamabad's side and mostly entailed by the political protests going on there. But what do you see as the longer-term strategic effect on the China-Pakistan bilateral relationship?
Well, in one sense, it's a very short-term thing, kind of a fluke. As you were saying, this is not that Xi Jinping decided he didn't want to go to Pakistan. The visit was made infeasible by these protests that are going on in Islamabad. It is not a good time to be hosting a bilateral visit. But at the same time, it is a missed opportunity for Pakistan to reassert its all-weather friendship with China, right as China is beginning this love fest that it's having with India. And it also sort of reinforces concerns that Beijing is increasingly having that Pakistan is not a secure environment. Obviously, in terms of investment, Pakistan is supposed to be part of the Silk Road and these economic corridors that China is trying to extend to its west. But there's a lot of concern that it's not a secure place for investments, that Chinese investments as well as Chinese citizens are at risk if they're increasing their presence in Pakistan. There's also obviously the concerns about terrorist organizations operating out of Pakistan's tribal regions, which is growing worrisome for China. So this sort of reinforces that notion that Pakistan might not be the most stable partner, and China might start backing off a little bit from its relationship with Pakistan if it continues to see these signs.
Mm-hmm. And have they rescheduled the visit already, or is that still up in the air?
They haven't. I mean, I think it obviously depends on how long these protests drag on, but there is every indication that the visit was postponed, not canceled. They are planning on rescheduling it. We're just not sure when.
Okay.
I mean, it depends also what happens. I mean, Sharif, I think he'll survive this, but I mean, it probably depends also on that. I mean, if he's going to stay in office or whatever.
Yeah, but whoever might take his place would still want to keep things moving with China.
Yeah, but they couldn't schedule the appointment. I mean, they couldn't schedule the visit without, like, you know, he's going to be in office. I mean, can I just real quick, and I don't mean to, I just want to push back a little bit. I obviously, I think China's worried about the Pakistan stability, but one, I think it's always been worried. I mean, I don't think China's missed that Pakistan's not a stable place. And two, I mean, you know, China has pretty strong ties with a lot of fairly unstable countries. I mean, look at North Korea. It's maintained great relations with North Korea for, you know, and especially before the Xi Jinping era, it maintained really good relations with North Korea, even though North Korea was causing all these problems. So I just think that the reason why China will still continue to have a strong relationship with Pakistan, because the reason why it has a strong relationship with Pakistan is for strategic reasons, and those strategic reasons aren't changing. I do think that it might affect their growing the plans to grow the economic relationship through infrastructure and stuff, because obviously it's going to be hard to build a highway and a railway through Pakistan if Pakistan's completely unstable. But I think that in terms of strategically, I don't think this really changes China's calculus.
Right. Yeah. I don't think that the relationship is going to devolve so much as I'm concerned it won't evolve. China has all of these economic initiatives that it's unfolding all around its immediate area, but particularly to the West. And if China says, well, Pakistan's kind of a bad risk and they get written off, that's a huge mischance for Pakistan's development and its economy. So we'll have to see how this affects China's calculations in that regard.
Yeah, I agree with that. But so I think that's definitely a concern. I also didn't China. China seems to be devolving a little bit from Pakistan on Afghanistan. I would note that. So maybe I am wrong, because didn't it sort of signed agreements or with like India and it's starting to bring like India and Russia on board in Afghanistan, and that's something obviously I think Pakistan doesn't want. So you could be right.
That's a whole separate can of worms. That'd be actually very interesting to do a podcast
next
on
podcast.
Looking at how looking at China India cooperation in Afghanistan. Very interesting. Unfortunately, I think that's all the time we have today, guys. Thanks a lot for joining me. Thanks a lot, Shannon, for coming on and just helping us, as usual, understand China better.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, we'll be back next week with more. Thanks for listening.